Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just now, the civil service is lost. Oh God, they've killed these people.
Israeli airstrikes on Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza have killed at least 20 people, including five Palestinian journalists from NBC, Reuters, AP, and Al Jazeera. According to eyewitnesses, Israel carried out a double-tap strike on the hospital. We'll get the latest. Meanwhile, on Friday, the UN formally declares a famine in the Gaza Strip. We'll go to Gaza City to speak with UNICEF's Tess Ingram.
Been warning about have come true. A famine is occurring in Gaza City, in the north of Gaza, and it's possible that within a couple of weeks, that famine will spread to other parts of the Gaza Strip.
Then Kilmer Abrego Garcia was freed from ICE detention after being held in El Salvador's notorious Secot prison.
My name is Kilmer Abrego Garcia. Today was a very special day because, thank God, I saw my family again after more than 160 days.
Now the U.S. government is threatening to deport Kilmer Abrego Garcia to Uganda, a country he has no connection to. He arrived at ICE's Baltimore office this morning. Then to George Redis, a disabled 25-year-old U.S. citizen Army veteran who was held by ICE for 3 days and nights without charge during a raid on a California farm. He's now suing the U.S. government. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli airstrikes on Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza have killed at least 20 people, including five Palestinian journalists. According to eyewitnesses, Israel carried out a double-tap strike on the hospital. A drone initially hit the hospital's roof, killing one journalist setting up a live stream. Then another strike hit journalists and rescue workers who were responding to the initial strike. During a live broadcast, Al-Ghad TV filmed the second strike on the hospital.
Just now, the civil service is lost. Oh God, they've killed these people.
The journalists killed in the Israeli strike have been identified as Hossam al-Masri, a photojournalist with Reuters news agency, Mohamed Salama, a photojournalist with Al Jazeera, Mariam Abudaka, a freelancer working with the Associated Press, Moaz Abu Taha, a journalist with NBC, and Ahmed Abu Aziz. On Saturday, another journalist was killed in Gaza, Mohamed Al-Madun, who worked at Palestine TV. At least 244 journalists have now been killed in Gaza over the past 23 months. Today's attack on Nasser Hospital came a day after Israeli forces killed at least 64 Palestinians, mostly in the north, as Israel moves to take over Gaza City and forcibly remove the city's entire population of almost 1 million. Officials in Gaza say Israel's recently destroyed more than 1,000 buildings in the Zeitoun and Sabra neighborhoods of Gaza City. Meanwhile, health officials in Gaza say 11 more Palestinians, including two children, have died from malnutrition over the past 24 hours. At least 300 Palestinians have starved to death. On Friday, the UN formally declared a famine in the Gaza Strip. We'll go to Gaza City to speak with UNICEF. Mass protests against Israel's war on Gaza continue across the globe. In Australia, an estimated 300,000 people participated in protests this weekend across the country. This is Larissa Joy Waters, the leader of the Australian Greens.
Australians are horrified that we are selling weapons components to the Israeli government. It's got to stop. And I'm excited at the sheer numbers of folk turning out right around the country the voice of Australians is really clear. We want peace, we want sanctions on the Israeli government, we want the aid to get through, and we want those weapons components and that two-way arms trade with Israel to stop.
Israeli fighter jets attacked the Yemeni capital of Sana'a Sunday, killing at least six people, injuring 86. The Israeli attack targeted a presidential palace, an oil facility, and a power plant. It came 2 days after Israel accused Houthi forces of using cluster munitions in a missile attack targeting Israel. A fire broke out at a Russian nuclear power plant in the western city of Kursk on Sunday after Russia shot down a Ukrainian drone near the plant. The fire caused some damage and reduced the plant's operating capacity by half. Ukraine launched a wave of drones on Sunday as the country marked its Independence Day. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Sunday there's no meeting planned yet between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In Washington, D.C., National Guard troops deployed by President Trump have begun carrying M-17 pistols or M-4 rifles. Last week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth authorized the troops to begin carrying weapons. More than 2,200 Guard troops are now in Washington. This comes as President Trump's threatening to send the National Guard to Chicago as well as New York and Baltimore in what would be a dramatic expansion of Trump's use of military force domestically. The Washington Post reports the administration's considering deploying thousands of National Guard members to Chicago, as well as possibly active duty troops. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson called the plan, quote, the most flagrant violation of our Constitution in the 21st century, unquote. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said, quote, Donald Trump is attempting to manufacture a crisis, politicize Americans who serve in uniform, and continue abusing his power to distract from the pain he's causing working families, unquote. On Friday, Trump claimed residents of Chicago want federal forces deployed.
And the people in Chicago, Mr. Vice President, are screaming for us to come. They're wearing red hats, just like this one. But they're wearing red hats. African-American ladies, beautiful ladies, are saying, please, President Trump, come to Chicago.
A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from cutting off federal funding from dozens of sanctuary cities, which include some of the largest cities in the United States, including Los Angeles and Chicago. President Trump had signed executive orders that would withhold federal funding from cities with laws that limit local police cooperation with ICE. In their lawsuit against the Trump administration, sanctuary cities and counties called these orders, quote, an abuse of power, arguing the Constitution allows them to not assist ICE activities within their jurisdiction. The Trump administration seeking to deport Kilmar Abrego-Garcia to Uganda just days after he was freed from ICE detention. Abrego-Garcia is the Maryland man who was wrongfully deported to the notorious Saycot prison in El Salvador and later returned to the U.S. On Friday, he was released in Tennessee, but he was ordered to report to the ICE field office in Baltimore today, which he has done. He reported to the ICE office this morning, where he is expected to be taken back into custody. Over the weekend, the immigrant advocacy group CASA released a short video of Kilmar Abrego-Garcia.
My name is Kilmar Abrego-Garcia. Today was a very special day because, thank God, I saw my family again after more than 160 days. I want to thank everyone who has been supporting me because after so much time, I am realizing that many people have been by my side with positivity, and I am thankful for them.
We'll have more on this story later in the program. We'll speak to Kilmar Abrego-Garcia's family lawyer. Democratic lawmakers are harshly criticizing the Trump administration over the FBI's raid Friday on the home of John Bolton, who served as Trump's national security advisor but later became a vocal critic. On Sunday, Democratic Senator Adam Schiff appeared on Meet the Press and said the raid is part of the administration's intimidation campaign to target administration critics.
What the president is trying to do here is very systemic and systematic, and that is anyone who stands up to the president, anyone who criticizes the president, anyone who says anything adverse to the president's interests gets the full weight of the federal government brought down on them.
On Sunday, Vice President J.D. Vance defended the raid on John Bolton's home.
We're in the very early stages of an ongoing investigation into John Bolton. I will say we're going to let that investigation proceed. What I can tell you is that unlike the Biden DOJ and the Biden FBI, our law enforcement agencies are going to be driven by law and not by politics.
The Trump administration's continuing its purge of high-ranking military and intelligence officials. On Friday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth fired the head of the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency, and another two senior military commanders. The move comes 2 months after a leaked DIA assessment contradicted President Trump's claim that U.S. strikes on Iran had obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. Here in New York, videos gone viral of Egyptian government employees grabbing and beating two Egyptian-American brothers who've been taking part in a pro-Palestine protest outside the Egyptian mission to the U.N.
They're bringing the kid inside the building. They're bringing the kid in the building. They're bringing the kid in the building. They're beating him with the, they're beating the kid with the chain. Can you guys bring somebody? Bring somebody. They're beating the kid with the chain. Bring somebody. They're beating the kid with the chain. Bring somebody. They're beating them inside. They're beating the kid and his brother. Yes, please.
In the video, Egyptian officials can be seen dragging the two brothers, aged 22 and 15 years old, into the mission and then using a chain and stick to beat them. When the New York police arrived, they arrested not the officials, but the two brothers. The boy's mother, Olga Al-Samak, criticized the NYPD, telling The Intercept, quote, I can expect it from the Egyptian security because this is a military-run country, but I wouldn't expect it from a police force that's supposed to protect American citizens, she said. The family of Jeffrey Epstein survivor, Virginia Giuffre, is accusing the Justice Department of giving former Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell a platform to rewrite history. On Friday, the DOJ released the transcript of the of Maxwell's interview with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche. Maxwell disputed allegations of wrongdoing against her and Epstein. She also questioned if Epstein had died by suicide in jail, and she praised President Trump, who has the power to pardon her. Giuffre's family said, quote, the content of these transcripts is in direct contradiction with felon Ghislaine Maxwell's conviction for child sex trafficking, unquote. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice has begun sending subpoenaed material on Epstein to the House Oversight Committee, but Democratic lawmakers say almost all the files had already been publicly released. In Texas, the Republican-controlled Senate passed new congressional maps that could flip as many as five House seats in favor of the GOP. In a statement, Republican Governor Greg Abbott said, quote, the one big, beautiful map has passed the Senate and is on its way to my desk where it will swiftly be signed into law, unquote. Earlier this month, more than 50 Democratic legislators temporarily fled Texas for 2 weeks to deny Republicans quorum needed to pass the new congressional maps. In the latest attack on the country's renewable energy industry, President Trump's ordered companies to stop construction on a wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island. The project was nearly completed, was set to deliver electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes by next year. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management sent a letter to one of the developers of the project saying the government was halting construction to, quote, address concerns related to the protection of national security interests, unquote. Earlier this year, the Trump administration had tried to stop a wind farm from being built off the coast of Long Island, but eventually allowed the project to proceed after New York Governor Kathy Hochul approved new gas pipelines in New York. The state of Florida has painted over a rainbow crosswalk that was part of a memorial to honor the 49 people killed at a gay nightclub in Orlando in 2016. At the time, it was the country's deadliest mass shooting. Orlando city officials weren't notified about the removal of the mural. The mayor of Orlando called it a, quote, cruel political act, unquote. People reportedly protested the state's move by scribbling the colors of the rainbow over the crosswalk. In a social media post, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis said, quote, we will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli airstrikes on Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza have killed at least 20 people, including 5 Palestinian journalists. According to eyewitnesses, Israel carried out a double-tap strike on the hospital. A drone initially hit the hospital's roof, killing one journalist setting up a live stream. Then another strike hit journalists and rescue workers who were responding to the initial strike. During a live broadcast, Al-Ghad TV filmed the second strike on the hospital.
Just now, the civil service is lost. Oh, God, they've killed these people.
The journalists killed in the Israeli airstrike have been identified as Hosma Masri, a photojournalist with the Reuters news agency, Mohammed Salama, a photojournalist with Al Jazeera, Marim Abu Dhaka, a freelancer who worked with the Associated Press, Moaz Abu Taha, a journalist with NBC, and Ahmed Abu Aziz. On Saturday, another journalist was killed in Gaza, Mohammed Al-Madun, who worked at Palestine TV. At least 244 journalists and media workers have now been killed in Gaza over the past 23 months. Today's attack on Nasser Hospital came a day after Israeli forces killed at least 64 Palestinians, mostly in the north, as Israel moves to take over Gaza City and forcibly remove the city's entire population of about 1 million people. Officials in Gaza say Israel's recently destroyed more than 1,000 buildings in the Zaytun and Sabra neighborhoods of Gaza City. Meanwhile, health officials in Gaza say 11 more Palestinians, including 2 children, have died from malnutrition over the past 24 hours. At least 300 Palestinians have starved to death. On Friday, the UN formally declared famine in the Gaza Strip. For more, we go to Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's chief communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Under incredibly painful circumstances. What do you understand happened with eyewitnesses talking about a double-tap strike on Nasser Hospital that killed at least 5 journalists, 20 people about altogether, with a focus on the fourth floor? The Reuters journalist was setting up a live stream on the roof when it happened.
Well, basically, it started with a journalist at Nasser Hospital called Hatem Omar, who located and spotted an Israeli surveillance quadcopter drone. He took a picture, uploaded it an hour before the strike, and said, "There is a quadcopter drone that is surveilling meticulously the area, so take cover, watch out." Israel knew exactly who was there. They bombed the fourth floor with a precision strike, because that is the area where journalists would go to catch a signal for their eSIM cards, because Israel collapsed Gaza's telecommunication infrastructure. So journalists rely on an electronic SIM card that catches a signal from Israeli telecom towers. So that's why they have to go to high up places, high rise buildings. Once they bombed it the first time, they waited patiently until more journalists and rescue workers rushed to the scene. And once they saw them, they bombed them again exactly at the moment that they were crowding to basically document the atrocities that unfolded there. So it's a precision double-tap strike that Israel unleashed to kill journalists specifically in the area where they knew that they would be standing every single day to upload documentation of the genocide.
Can you talk about Israel's response? They said they're investigating.
That's the exact same response that they gave about Yasser Murtaja in 2018 when they murdered him with a sniper shot directly, despite wearing a press-marked vest. First, they said he was Hamas. Then they said it was an accident. Then, when all of their lies were debunked repeatedly, they said, "We will investigate." And we never heard anything about it again for the next 7 years until this moment. Investigate is Israel's way of buying time. I have Israeli contacts in Israeli civil society, like Breaking the Silence and B'Tselem, that said that Israel previously was unwilling to investigate itself. At this stage, it is incapable of investigating itself because the military is overfilled with religious Zionist extremists. It's basically the Israeli military that's carrying out the genocide in Gaza is overstaffed with the most extreme Israeli settlers, particularly from the hilltop youth. And you wouldn't expect those people to investigate their atrocities, let alone the people that were there before them. Israel's investigations are basically the same sham that is there to buy time. That's why B'Tselem decided many years ago to stop collaborating with any Israeli state investigation, because they said these are theater plays, performances that is there to just whitewash Israeli atrocities on the ground. So it's completely meaningless.
Can you tell us about the other journalists and their reporting? So you have Hassam Al-Masri, the photojournalist from Reuters News Agency, was setting up a live stream on the roof. And then there's Mariam Aboudaka. She's with AP, a freelancer with AP, a mom. She was doing profiles, especially of children in Nasser Hospital.
So Mariam, she's a giant icon on her own. Basically, she's a journalist, a mother. She recently donated her kidney to save a life quietly. Her son is receiving medical treatment outside of Gaza, Gaith. She is basically a very close friend of Razan al-Najjar, the paramedic that was killed again in a targeted sniper shot during the Great March Return in 2018. And Mariam was covering these demonstrations. At one point, she was broadcasting live when a body arrived to the hospital. She looked behind, and it turned out to be her own brother that was killed by Israel while marching bare-chested against Israel's draconian blockade on Gaza, and collapsed in tears immediately. She lost another brother during the genocide. She's a neighbor of Mohammed Salama, the other journalist that was killed in their strike. And Mohammed recently got engaged, and he was preparing to get married. He's a young journalist from the same area, Abasan and Khan Yunis, a village that Israel wiped out completely. They left nothing in there, and they bragged about it on camera. They took thorough documentation that Abasan was turned into a howling wilderness and showed it to Gazans to basically shock them. Even in Israeli prisons, Ben-Gvir, the Israeli minister of security, he hung up a giant poster of Gaza being reduced to rubble for Palestinian hostages to see it every single day and realize that the genocide is going through. The other journalists, Mu'adh Taha and Hamza, both of them, none of the four journalists had anything to do with Hamas or militant activity. Nonetheless, you have Channel 14, an Israeli TV channel, that is now bragging and saying, yes, we bombed the Nasser Hospital twice. Yes, we killed those journalists. And yes, those journalists are terrorists. And that's the end of the story. So in English, Israel is saying one thing. They're saying it's a mistake. In Hebrew, they're bragging about it. They're delighting in the killing of those journalists. Right now, Israel has killed 244 journalists, by far surpassing all 20 years of the war in Vietnam or all 6 years of the Second World War. And you remember, Amy, in Vietnam, there were pictures like the napalm girl that turned public opinion around. There was the picture from Lebanon in 1982 of a girl with both of her arms wrapped in bandages that made President Reagan call the Israeli prime minister and say, this is a Holocaust, you need to stop now. But when it comes to Gaza, you don't see that tipping point at all. No matter what Israel does, there is no tipping point for the international community that's empowering Israel genocide.
And let's remember that well, over 200 Palestinian journalists and media workers have been killed. You said 244, Mohammed. The Israeli prime minister, the military, does not allow in international journalists. Mohammed Shahada, I want to thank you very much for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to stay in Gaza. And perhaps the first time famine has been declared outside the African continent, the UN-backed IPC has declared a full-blown catastrophic famine in Gaza City. The classification is characterized by, quote, starvation, destitution, and death, with one in three children acutely malnourished. Unless Israel's near-total blockade on food is lifted, the famine's expected to expand to Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis in coming weeks. Many aid agencies have life-saving aid sitting in warehouses outside Gaza, ready to enter. For more, we go to Gaza City. We're joined by Tess Ingram, spokesperson for UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. Tess, thanks so much for being with us. You heard about what happened at Khan Yunis at Nasser Hospital. Of course, there are so many patients there, children, adults, journalists, doctors, staff. From where you stand, this in the midst of the declaration by the UN that the Gaza Strip is in famine. Can you comment?
The rules of war are clear. Healthcare must be protected, as should journalists and all civilians, including children and humanitarian aid workers. And yet throughout this conflict, we've seen a constant disregard for the rules of war. And I saw it today here in Gaza City. I went to three hospitals, and at every hospital, I was met with rooms full of injured children, children with amputations, with horrific blast injuries, with fractures, with multiple shrapnel wounds and internal injuries. It is among the worst that I've seen. I was shocked by what I witnessed today in the hospitals. And on top of that, of course, we have the crisis of famine. Children with malnutrition at a screening center I was at again today. All but one child that was screened had malnutrition while I was there. And that one child has been receiving treatment from UNICEF and hasn't gotten better over the last 3 weeks. But it is everywhere, Amy. Everywhere we look, children are being disproportionately affected by this horror.
Tell us what the IPC is. It's actually quite a conservative organization within the United Nations. If you can talk about what it means to declare famine.
They are quite conservative. They're a group of independent technical experts. So this group look at data specifically, and they look at it in the context of food insecurity. And they do this all the way around the world, from Somalia to Sudan, South Sudan. And now, of course, they've been watching the situation in Gaza for many, many months now. They actually first warned of the risk of famine in December 2023. And since then, they have been monitoring, collecting evidence and data. So for them to make this classification on Friday of a famine in Gaza City and the risk of that spreading and quickly to Deir al-Bala and Khan Yunis is a very significant moment. It is a rare moment for the IPC to make such a finding, and it is backed by 50 pages of evidence behind that claim. So we take that very seriously. Of course, we know here on the ground that the situation has been bad for so many months. One girl I spoke to yesterday, Sarah, she's 14 here in Gaza City, and she said to me, famine, of course I know. I've been starving for 5 months now. And I think that is the view of so many people here. But they were relieved that this really well-regarded group has put that on the international stage. And hopefully world leaders will take it and use it as a catalyst to finally do something to try and get more aid to these children.
Can you talk about the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? UNICEF, your organization, has been clear it will not participate in the militarization of aid. Over 200 NGOs have said that. Who are they? And what is happening when Palestinians race to sites, children, adults, to try to get food?
We as the United Nations, including UNICEF, have been very clear that we will not participate in the model that the GHF is using because it does not meet our humanitarian principles of impartiality, of neutrality. And what that means in practice really is that we take aid to people where they are in their places of refuge, and we deliver it to them with safety and with dignity. And we did that during the ceasefire as a good example. We had 400 distribution points all over Gaza so that we could bring the aid to the people where they were safely and with dignity. Now, we are seeing the opposite at the moment from these sites. There's just four of them. And we are seeing those apocalyptic scenes of people rushing to try and get what they can from these sites, of people being shot at while they are trying to do that. In our mind, that does not work. It does not meet the humanitarian principles that we adhere to, and that is why we are not working with that model. What we are asking for is for us to be allowed to do our jobs. We are being hampered every step of the way at the moment, and we want to be able to scale up. And we need to be able to scale up because a famine is underway in Gaza. It's more important now than it ever has been. So it's critical that the UN is allowed to work.
Can you explain what actually happens with these hundreds of trucks that are trying to get into Gaza right now?
That's right. We've got hundreds of trucks outside waiting to come into the Gaza Strip, including with life-saving supplies for children, equipment for hospitals that's so desperately needed. And look, there's no good reason why that cannot be allowed in with urgency. But what we're seeing is those trucks not being allowed to cross, for example, at Kerem Shalom in the south. But then we have challenges inside too. Even the few trucks that come into the Gaza Strip, those trucks are offloaded at a crossing, and then we have to get permission to go and collect the aid from the crossing. It's not a drive-through, Amy. We can't just go there whenever we like to collect the supplies. We have to ask for permission. We have to receive what we call a green light to undertake that mission. Sometimes we might get the permission, but then we are delayed for many hours before we can leave, or we're delayed along the way. We face waiting at holding points. So